And yes, WeWork was always on the burn rate model. It never hit profitability. But there was the hope that it would turn the corner sometime and get there. And it certainly was growing very fast. And it is true that when a company is growing very fast, it's hard to be profitable at the same time.
You're listening to Bite Sized Business Law, where we discuss big issues in small doses. This podcast is sponsored by the Fordham University School of Law Corporate Law Center, which is run by Fordham Law Professor Richard Squire and me, your host, Amy Martella. Okay, let's get down to business.
Welcome back to Bite Sized Business Law. Today we're talking about office sharing company WeWork, which has recently been in the news. WeWork has suffered one of the most spectacular corporate collapses in recent U.S. history. Valued in 2019 at $47 billion, the company has now filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in a New Jersey bankruptcy court. And since going public in 2021, WeWork has lost 98% of its value. Here to give us all the juicy details about this saga is our friend Richard Squire. Richard is a professor of business law here at Fordham Law School and the faculty director of the Corporate Law Center. Richard, welcome.
Amy, it's nice to be back.
It's nice to have you. And I know you always say that you like to tell your students that your reorg class that you teach should really be called Debt and Resurrection.
Right.
And I feel like today's discussion is a company that fits actually nicely into that idea.
Yes, I think it should be called Debt and Resurrection, or even the idea that debt sounds like death and resurrection is rising from the dead. And the question is, how many times has WeWork already risen from the dead?
Yeah. And will it rise again?
And will it rise again?
Yeah.
That's right. It might in a smaller form.
Yes, we'll get to that. Okay, so give us some background. What is WeWork and what was this innovative concept that it brought to the market?
Right. So I find this a very interesting story for many reasons. I feel like this is a case, and this is often true of cases that end up in bankruptcy, companies that end up failing. They, in some ways, represent not just something that's happening in the business world and the economy, but they reflect American economic history and even social history and cultural history. And I love history. I'm not as interested in the history that we tend to learn in school, which focuses, at least when I was taught, it was primarily political history and maybe some military too. So here are the presidents and here are the wars. That's all very interesting. But I really like, increasingly, I like economic and social history. I also like the history of language, by the way. I want to recommend to all of our listeners another podcast. I don't know if you will permit me to do that. It's a competitor. Okay, it's the History of English podcast. Somebody recently put me onto this, and I'm very excited about it. Again, it's history, but not history, not political history, but the history of the English language. And I mention it because it was founded maybe 10 years ago by a guy named Kevin Stroud. I know he's one of our secret listeners. So I hope that, no, I don't know that.
Hi, Kevin.
Yeah. Right. But let's assume it. And I'm hoping that if we plug his podcast, he'll plug ours. So anyway, the reason that I feel like WeWork is reflecting, first of all, let's talk about American cultural history. Yeah. So in a way, WeWork is, at least when I first read about the business model, it didn't strike me as particularly new or unique. Or you could say it was an application of an old business model to something new. It's kind of a retailer of office space. So what do retailers do? Well, they buy in bulk and then they sell in smaller pieces. They assume the risk associated with buying in bulk, and then they mark up by selling in smaller pieces. Sometimes they'll add some value to whatever they're selling, and WeWork did that. And they assume the risk on behalf of the provider of whatever it is in bulk. And so it's very clear if you go to a grocery store, the grocery store is buying fruits and vegetables in bulk and then selling individual apples and oranges at a markup to the customers. And here, what WeWork is doing is buying office space in bulk, but the bulk reflects time. So it would lease from a owner of an office building certain floors or maybe the whole building, but I think it was typically just a few floors for a long time, or 10 or 20 years. So bulk here would be the time, the months. And then it would try to lease it out to people who wanted to use the space for a shorter period, or at least wouldn't want to commit for a shorter period. So in that way, it's kind of a standard retailing or standard middleman business. Maybe doing it with office space is a little bit different, but that model has precedent certainly in the economy. And then the other thing that it reminds me of, and it's a little bit like fractional reserve banking in reverse. And we've talked about fractional reserve banking earlier on the podcast together when we talked about why Silicon Valley Bank failed. where, and other banks, whereas they accept, so they borrow on a very short-term and demand basis from their depositors. They take money from their depositors and the depositors get it back at any time. And then they invest it long-term and hoping to make money on that spread. And here, Stillwork is doing the opposite, which is borrowing land long-term and then lending it out short-term and hoping to make a profit on that spread. So there's a way in which there are clear precedents for this type of business. Although again, the application in this particular industry may be a little bit new. But there's also something new going on, which is makes the kind of the story of the company and its founder interesting. So the founder, Newman, he talked about, when you read about him, about like his inspiration for the company, he says, well, he grew up in Israel, and I get the sense that maybe he grew up in one of the kibbutzes, or I think maybe the plural in Hebrew is kibbutzim, but I don't know, or kibbutzim, I don't know. Some listeners are probably screaming at their phones right now, so this is not how you say it. But those, at least traditionally, the kibbutzes had a cultural history and a motivation of sharing, of kind of being more socialist in a sense that there's a community where everybody pitches in and does the work together and everything is shared communally. And he said things like, I got this inspiration for my business based on this notion that back in Israel, when he was growing up, he really liked the sharing and community. And so he wanted to bring that to WeWork. And you might think, well, what's the sharing and community in WeWork? Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, investors have characterized this company as being part of the sharing economy. Other companies would be Uber and Airbnb. The idea that there's some assets like a car or a house that instead of just having one person use it for a long period of time, many people can use it short term. So that's what happens with an Uber, right? That so different riders get in and get out, maybe dozens of them over the course of a day. So they're kind of sharing the car over the course of the day. Same with Airbnb, different people sharing a house or a part of a house. And so the notion was people could share office space. And this could either be actually the short-term leases that WeWork was facilitating would be for shared space for people to come in and have a place to go to work outside their home. If they were freelancers or something like that, didn't have an office to go to. So it might be shared space in a real time sense. But even if it was a startup company that was going to lease for a short term, but occupy the office space exclusively during the course of its short lease, the lease might turn over quickly. So other people might come in and share. Well, that was one way he said, well, I'm kind of into sharing, you know, and so this is going to be the sharing model. And by touting that, I think he made it attractive, maybe to investors, but maybe also to workers, employees who wanted to feel like they were part of a business that had some kind of broader social aim and broader social purpose. And he fueled that also by other things that he would talk about. Apparently, Newman would say things like, I see WeWork is not just being a viable business and an exciting business, but also one thing I want to do is I want to raise world consciousness, kind of vague, but it's like there's a real social mission here. I saw a report that said he wanted to be the world's first trillionaire, and he was going to use the money for philanthropic and other social purposes. So there's a little bit of Sam Bankman-Fried kind of feel to it, where the kind of the effective altruism movement, obviously there may be defamatory even to suggest a connection between the two. And I'm not suggesting that Newman engaged in any kind of the fraud that Sam Bankman-Fried has now been convicted of. I also saw on Wikipedia, talking about another sharing space, right? Everybody can share the editing there, that Newman has retained his own defamation attorney, who's very good. So I want to be very clear. I'm not accusing him in any way of being like Bankman-Fried in terms of fraud. But this notion, again, that you can recruit young people, maybe people under 35, under 30, to a business, not just to give those people a job. What they're seeking is not just a job, but some kind of sense of social meaning. And so I feel like WeWork was using that to recruit people to get excited about coming there. And so this now connects back to what I was saying earlier about American kind of economic history. When I look at my parents and my grandparents, I don't think, and in those generations, it was primarily the fathers who would work. I don't, although not exclusively, but more so than now, I don't think that they selected jobs thinking, I really want a place that has a lot of social mission. That may have been nice, but they were getting meaning in their lives, either not primarily from their jobs or through their jobs, but in a different way. So I think that many people in older generations would say, well, I want to get a job because I want to raise a family and support my family. And so the meaning of my job, a lot of it is the paycheck that I bring home. Younger people today aren't forming families as young. They're not having as many children. So just providing, being the provider for others doesn't have the same, I think, draw by employers. So they have to add something else, like raising social consciousness or sharing the other things that WeWork and Newman was touting. Also, this is a cultural reference from the 1985 movie, St. Elmo's Fire. I hope some of the listeners have seen this movie. There's this amazing scene. It's very subtle, where one of the characters who is either, based on the dating, either very late baby boomer or very early Gen X. So born in the mid 60s. So now would be maybe approaching retirement. But there's this amazing scene where she says, last night, I got up in the middle of the night and I made myself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And it tasted so good. Why? Because I made it in my own apartment. I bought the peanut butter. I bought the jelly. And the idea is that then getting a job was a part of a rite of passage. It was a way of establishing that you're a grown up. And so it, peanut butter and jelly, even if you're having still infantile food, no offense to anyone out there, I still eat peanut butter and jelly, but it's kind of a kid's meal. But even if you're having that, it tastes better if you paid for it yourself. So a job, the meaning of the job, some of it was just, it symbolizes becoming a grown up. I don't feel like in younger generations, that emphasis on trying to be a grown up as quickly as possible is there. People cheered when Obamacare said, you can stay on your parents' medical plan until you're 26, right? So like this delayed maturity. So again, if you're not getting these basic sources of meaning that previous generations got from their job, like providing for your family and represent having a rite of passage into adulthood, then employers have to find other ways to draw you in. And I feel like Newman was very good at that, at least for a while. And he was doing it on a business model that I felt was otherwise was not particularly remarkable in terms of inspiring, right? Well, I lease land, office space long-term, and then I rent it out short-term. But I'm going to transform this into some kind of social meaning and some kind of consciousness raising worldwide. It's a clever and interesting phenomenon. And I think he represented that, and WeWork represented that in many ways.
Yeah, he certainly capitalized on the sharing economy
yes.
that has arisen in the last like 10 to 15 years. And he definitely had that social angle because the first iteration, I don't know if you remember, the first iteration of his company was something called Green Desk.
Right.
Where you could, as an individual, just rent out space so you can get out of the, you know, the coffee shop and you can do your work at a desk, which is, again, rented by his company. He ended up selling that and scaling right. it up to become WeWork.
Right.
But he definitely had that green and community yeah. type.
Right. Of- right. So people want to know mm-hmm. that what they're doing is not just making a valuable product or service for the customer, but also it has support social goals like sustainability or the economy. Obviously, the green kind of angle is there. Starbucks, for a while, I don't visit Starbucks as much as I used to. For a while, it was selling fair trade coffee. I don't even remember this term. The notion was that Starbucks would deliberately pay more for beans than it had to because it wanted to buy its beans at a what it would call a sustainable price from farmers that earned enough money from the beans to have a certain minimum level of, I guess, quality of life. We said, we're not going to buy beans from other farmers, maybe in different countries, who are trying to undercut them and sell at cutthroat prices because that wasn't good for farmers in the long run. And it was fascinating because basically what Starbucks was saying to its customers is you pay more for your coffee here than you have to. We are deliberately not buying the cheapest beans. Even if you hold quality constant, we're paying more than we need to for our beans. And that means you're going to pay more for your coffee for other purposes. But this worked for Starbucks because the customers don't just want another cup of coffee, which is basically a commodity. They want some kind of social meaning mixed in with their brew, you know? And so that was being pitched to customers. Other companies are pitching it also to investors and to their employees, right, which is right. WeWork was doing.
So, okay. So now we know a little bit about WeWork and its business model.
Right.
You spoke briefly about Adam Newman, the founder. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit more about him, particularly his management style, because that ended up being a big problem for WeWork.
Yeah. So I feel like a lot of this is kind of gossipy.
Yeah.
So I read the same reports that are available to everybody else. So this is all secondhand. When I said secondhand, for some reason, it reminded me of the term secondhand smoke. And I think there was a fair amount of that at the offices, because I think one of the things he was doing, he was known for, was smoking pot with his employees. There was apparently some flight to Israel where he rented a private jet and he and his employees smoked marijuana all the way out there, to the point that when it arrived, the plane got impounded or something or seized and they had to fly back by commercial flights and so on. So, I mean, clearly, you know, that's kind of green, I guess, too, in a way. But I guess his management style was trying to, in some ways, create an environment that was interesting to his employees beyond, or meaningful to his employees beyond just being a place to work and get a paycheck. So apparently some of the, there are ping pong tables at the offices and so on, a little bit more things, a way to appeal to make it fun for millennials to go to work there. Some of the reports also would mention a lot of these millennials actually don't have families. They're not, so they didn't mind working longer hours, or you could more easily induce them to work longer hours because they don't have anywhere to go home to. That's interesting, especially if you made the workplace kind of fun. Certainly, I guess things like ping pong and pot would, could be inducements for some people to stay at the office. But it's interesting also because while trying to create a workspace that had appeal beyond just being a paycheck for his workers, he also was known for encouraging his workers to work very hard, to work long hours, and trying to motivate them with various slogans and so on, and trying to get them very passionate about what they were doing. So I think there was some perception that he was a bit of a slave driver. Some of the people that he would hire as a senior managers encourage long hours. And so it was not actually a place where you would have much work-life balance. Work and life were all together at the office for many years. And just to be clear, he left as CEO in 2019. So this is reflective of a, of kind of a work environment that may have changed since he left four years ago. It's not the same. It is the same bankrupt company, but things have presumably changed in many ways since he left 4 years ago. The other thing that is notable about him is that the reason he left in 2019 was the company was about to do an initial public offering, and it was about to be listed on stock exchange. It did subsequently get listed on stock exchanges 2 years later by a different mechanism. But in an IPO, in an initial public offering, the company has to disclose all kinds of things about itself and about its managers to the public. And what came out in these disclosures indicated that Newman was extracting a fair amount of money from the company in various ways. So he wasn't just drawing a salary, as you would expect the CEO to do. And also, he didn't just have shares, lots of them, as you expect the CEO to have, but he trademarked the term "we," which I wouldn't expect to be trademarkable, but there it is. And then he forced the company to pay him to use that trademark, so he made a lot of money of royalties on that. There were other mechanisms by which he would take money out. He would move in and out of Forbes' list of the country's billionaires based on the stock price, but when he got out with quite a bit of money, so that when the company finally did get listed in 2021, even though he was no longer an officer of the company, that listing on the stock exchange raised him back up to be a billionaire. So what's interesting is that now the company's in bankruptcy and many investors are going to take very deep losses, but he's aloof from that. He got out kind of before the bubble on his own company bursts, and he's sitting on lots of money. And unlike with the case of Bankman-Fried, and again, I want to, for any attorney that might be listening, make another distinction. There's no allegation that what he did was fraud or that he stole from the company. These were kind of contracts that he entered into. There were shareholder lawsuits over some of this, but it wasn't rising to the level that I know of criminal activity. I don't feel like this is a suggest that he's ripped anybody off and he has a lot of money, even though the company has failed. It feels like everybody who was agreeing to this thing kind of knew what they were doing. And he was clearly trying to protect himself so that he wasn't exposed to all the risk of the company. He had created a lot of value, at least initially, want to protect it. So it's all kind of sophisticated players involved in this. And they just let him have that money that they knew this would be the board of directors or investors who are signing off on these transfers of money to him. They all knew that if the company ended up bankrupt, he wouldn't be on the hook for it, and they allowed it anyway. So it is interesting that he's gone on to other things and he still has lots of money to do it with.
Yeah, it's like the greatest irony of this story is that the timing for the company was terrible. Mm-hmm. But the timing for Newman could not have been more perfect. 2019, he got out with his $2 billion.
Right, right. Yes. And I know you're not implying that he's responsible personally for the pandemic, just a way to sell the company short. No. But you're right. The pandemic must be mentioned, COVID, in that we all know that COVID during the lockdown years, but even continuing subsequent, 2020, 2021, subsequent, greatly reduced demand for office space, office property, commercial property, that many people now are working from home, or when they go into an office, they go part-time. So a law firm, maybe even here in Manhattan, needs less office space because it's only, people might share an office more because they're only coming in two or three times a week, so it's easy to share with others. So demand for the very product that WeWork was selling collapsed during the lockdown years. Now, the company was able to go public through a SPAC, which is another way to go to public. Initially, it's a way to go public, to get listed on a stock exchange with a little bit less disclosure to the public about what you're doing.
Wait, so tell us, Richard, they tried to go public once, right? In 2019.
Yes.
Why did that fail?
Because investors didn't like what they were seeing in terms of Newman's own management style and also the amount of money he was extracting. So the company had to kind of reinvent itself to a certain extent, or rebrand itself without him.
Did they vote him out? How does that work? Did he resign? I mean, I read that he also cast a vote against him.
Yeah, I believe the board voted hired him out. I mean, the board ultimately hires the CEO, but I think he knew the writing was on the wall that his company was never going to be able to succeed in the way that he would want it to with him still at the helm. If he's still holding shares and he's still hoping that the company will go public someday, it's in his interest to make the company attractive for public investors, even if it means that he's no longer there. So voting against yourself, voting for your own resignation may not be entirely in your contrary to your economic interests. If you think, well, by doing this, it will allow the company to go public and he'll make money that way, which he did. So he left and the company started working on reinventing himself. Now you may think, how in the world did it go public in 2021? That was kind of the depth of the market for commercial real estate. But two things were happening then. One was there was hope that once the lockdowns were over, there would be a new surge of demand for office space, that this kind of work from home thing was going to be more temporary. In a way, it proved not to be. It proved a real testing kind of ground or opportunity for Zoom and related products. And people said, I like this permanently and I can work more permanently this way.
Yeah, we can't not putting the genie back in that bottle.
Right. Yeah. So you may think, did COVID kill WeWork? No. I mean, in a way, COVID accelerated it, but it was Zoom and similar products that have really destroyed the business model at the scale that it existed before. There may be a smaller version that will emerge from bankruptcy. But at the same time that there was some optimism in 2021 that the real estate, commercial real estate market would come back, the Federal Reserve was pumping money into the economy, which is something that, you know, I like to talk about, bet noir, the Federal Reserve, in hopes of stimulating the economy. So there's lots of money sloshing around. And when there's money sloshing around, it goes into all kinds of places. We saw it going into higher prices for goods and services. I don't know if you've noticed, but the grocery store is certainly more expensive. Your bill is higher, especially eating out or having a beer at a bar is much more expensive now than before. So there was price increases in consumer goods, but there's also were price increases in investment assets. There's more money sloshing around looking for assets to buy stuff. So a company that might not have seemed very attractive before now is going to get bid up because there's a lot of people looking for money to invest. And so the SPAC device for bringing companies public kind of got a shot in the arm in the short run by the Fed when it was pumping money into the economy. And so people said, okay, we have all this cash, we have all this liquidity, let's give this company a try. Let's give WeWork a try. Now, once the inflation started really coming through into the consumer price index, then the Federal Reserve, of course, it raised interest rates, it started sucking money out of the economy. And that kind of put the end to that bubble. There was not a lot of easy money from investors anymore. And WeWork was still not making a profit. It was still losing huge amounts of money. It was still finding it difficult to find short-term tenants to lease its properties. And so it ended up in bankruptcy.
So tell us though, I wanted to ask you about this last-ditch effort it made in August. So I read that in August, it tried a debt restructuring before filing for bankruptcy.
Right.
So it sounds very technical. So I was wondering if you could unpack it for us. It announced a 1-for-40 reverse stock split to get its shares trading back at a dollar, which is the requirement to stay on the exchange.
Right.
What does that all mean?
There's two, I think, different things going on, but they're related to the company's economic struggles. So there's the debt restructuring, which in some ways is continuing in bankruptcy because it's a negotiation between the company and its various creditors, which include not only investors, but also all of these landlords that have leased its properties. It owes them money. It owes money on the leases. But just go back to the reverse stock split. The New York Stock Exchange has a rule that a stock can't trade at less than a dollar per share for an extended period. I don't know if it's a week or a month. There's some rule about it. I speculate about why. I'm sure there's an official reason. But generally, the companies, stocks that trade for less than a dollar share are penny stocks. That's the old term for them. They were often seen as kind of the place where fraudsters would operate because they would try to sell people on big dreams. So they would say, this company's only selling for pennies. For a very small investment, you could make a huge amount of money. And by the way, that is true. If, you know, if a company is selling for 10 cents a share and it jumps to just a dollar per share, which is only a small increase, 90 cents, but it's a 10-time increase, you can make 10 times your investment. And so the movie The Wolf of Wall Street involved a guy who initially was selling penny stocks, but it's often an arena for fraudsters, or at least for people who are kind of vulnerable to being persuaded, you know, swindlers. And so I think the New York Stock Exchange said, we don't want to be associated with that. We trade more stable stocks and so on. Also, when a company is trading for less than a dollar, it's often because it's very close to bankruptcy. And so the exchange doesn't want shareholders to buy a stock in ignorance of the fact that it's very soon likely to file for bankruptcy, and often the shareholders then get nothing. One way then to boost your share price when you're trading so low, below a dollar per share. I mean, the way you should do it is by making your company more profitable, right? So the intrinsic value increases. But the other way to do it is the reverse stock split. So a stock split is where you increase the number of shares that are trading. That's the standard way you do this. That's the most people know about a stock split. So for every one share you're holding, you'll get two shares or three shares. That's usually a sign the company's doing fabulously well, and the share price is now $500 or $1,000 per share, and it's hard for people to invest even in one share. The reverse is where you're selling at a very low price, and you say, okay, for every 40, this is what we worked at, for every 40 shares that are outstanding, we're going to give you one new share. So the value of a new share, in theory, would be 40 times the value of an old share, so you could get back above the $1 mark. It's totally arbitrary in the sense that you're satisfying a rule, but you're making a stock exchange rule, but you're not making the company any more economically viable.
Right.
And it's back down, of course, below a dollar a share again.
Yes.
Although there's been trading recently, speculation obvious recently about, will the company emerge from bankruptcy with some value for its shareholders? And this happened with Hertz in 2021. This is something that bankruptcy people actually worry about a bit, because again, it looks like maybe innocent or naive investors are getting exploited in this kind of situation.
Yeah.
So that was one thing that you asked about, which was the stock split, the reverse stock split. WeWork has filed for Chapter 11 protection. This is the resurrection part of debt and resurrection, because in the Chapter 11, the hope is the company is not going to liquidate, but it's actually going to reemerge and it's a viable business. And so what Chapter 11 really is a big negotiation between the company and its creditors. They have certain claims on the company and they may be able to get the liquidation value of their claims, but the company says, well, we can drag this out for a while so we can delay satisfaction even of your liquidation value of your claims. But also maybe if we restructure, you will get ultimately more value because we're going to preserve the company's going concern value. And so there's a negotiation between the company, the debtor, the company, and its creditors about how much they're going to get out of the bankruptcy proceeding. And the hope for the creditors is that they're not going to get 100% of what's very rare, of 100% of what they're owed, but maybe they'll get better than nothing or better than the very small amount they would get just in a pure liquidation. Now, people can anticipate that a company is going to file for Chapter 11 and start those negotiations even before the bankruptcy filing. So the mere threat of a bankruptcy filing, and it's not considered extortion to threaten to file for bankruptcy in order to get concessions from your creditors. It's a legitimate tool that the bankruptcy code puts in the hands of debtors, negotiating tool. And so WeWork started negotiating both with the landlords, which is the bulk of its actual debt obligations, but also its bondholders and other bank creditors. I'd say, look, you're not going to get 100 cents on the dollar. We're not a viable company. People aren't going back to work in sufficient numbers. But let's work something out so that we don't have to liquidate and you can get something. So those negotiations started outside bankruptcy. The company wasn't able to renegotiate enough of these leases, these long-term leases, to achieve viability outside bankruptcy. So now it's going the bankruptcy route and renegotiating more leases and canceling many as well. And so bankruptcy provides a very powerful way for the debtor to renegotiate those leases, because in the bankruptcy proceeding, a lessee, somebody who is leasing land, who files for bankruptcy, the debtor can reject a lease. And what that does is says, I'm not going to honor this lease anymore. And so counterparty, then the lessor, the landlord here, would have a claim, but it would be an unsecured claim for whatever would it remained as owed on the lease with normal damages, adjustments, and contract law. And so it might just be pennies in the dollar, because an unsecured claim might not get much. In addition, it looks like what WeWork did was it held most of its leases, not at the parent level, but at the level of lots of individual subsidiaries. It looked like lots of LLCs that would be formed just to hold maybe one or two leases in a particular region. Like I saw one called Beacon Hill. So I'm assuming this was in Boston, although it may not have been. So the assets of the particular legal entity that the landlord would have a claim against may be nothing. There may be almost nothing in there. And so the negotiation is, look, I'll reject your lease and you'll have a damages claim against an entity that doesn't hold anything. Now, we work quite a bit of negotiating leverages to say, do you want nothing? Did nothing suit you? How's never? You know, does never work for you? Like you're never going to get paid, or maybe you'll give me better terms and then I will offer to pay you something. And so some of the leases have just been outright already rejected by WeWork. So we're never going to make this property viable. The landlord is now free to try to lease that property to somebody else and try to collect any pennies and damages that they can collect from us in the bankruptcy proceeding. But others, there's active negotiations still going on, and WeWork has up to 210 days, basically 7 months from its bankruptcy filing, to do these negotiations before it has to finally go to the court for each of these leases and say, either we're going to accept the lease on either the previous terms or new terms that we've negotiated with landlord, or we're just going to reject the lease and then walk away from it. And so that's what most of the action action is now. Most of the lawyers are doing is negotiating with these various landlords, trying to get the burden of lease payments on the company down low enough that the company can become profitable.
And isn't there something like 700 locations where they leased property? And that doesn't mean there's 700 landlords.
Right.
But there's a lot of negotiation to be done.
A lot of negotiation to be done. Also, WeWork was setting up all over the world, runs a little Uber in this way. And the bankruptcy only affects its leases in the United States and Canada. Now, that is a lot of its leases.
What will happen with its leases abroad?
Well, those continue to be enforceable under local law. Now, WeWork could, in theory, whatever entities it has or subsidiaries it has overseas, put them into a foreign bankruptcy proceeding. But so far, it's really focused on the American operations, the North American operations. And I'm guessing that's where the bulk of the liabilities are. I mean, it was an American company, and I think that's where the most of the business. I mean, its largest holdings are right here in Manhattan. I guess I read it was Southern Midtown, which these real estate people slice kind of the map very finely. So Southern Midtown, that's where it holds more land than any other tenant WeWork does. But it's still only 5% of the office space in Midtown. So this isn't like a systemic risk where the whole real estate industry, the commercial real estate industry, is going to fail because WeWork has failed. It's more of a symptom of difficulties in that industry.
So looking at the bankruptcy and all the details that you just described to us, what do you think will happen to WeWork? Do you think it will emerge from the bankruptcy?
I think it will. It seems like it's a fairly straightforward proposition to find a core of a viable business here. Because if we can just aggressively strip out all of the non-functioning properties, those where the company just can't find short-term tenants to cover any reasonable amount of rental payments. Because there may be places where the landlord actually is fine with rejection of the lease, saying like there's no demand in this place at all for your product WeWork. So I would be happy if you walked away. I get the land back and I could convert it to apartments, right? That's what's happening to some of this commercial space, right? So some of these places this is just a process of pruning away the properties where the WeWork model just doesn't work. But there's presumably are a few properties where the model does still work. I just read today that WeWork has successfully renegotiated a lease on some property right here in New York, 42nd and Broadway, or around that area, where the tenant is Amazon. And WeWork is standing between Amazon, the tenant, and the owner of the land. And Amazon is still viable business, clearly very viable. That's one that's doing well in the new economy. And so can make the payments on the lease that well exceed what the landlord, the ultimate owner of the property, requires, and WeWork can profit on the spread, on the difference. So there have to be many properties like that. It may be just 10% of all the properties that WeWork currently is leasing, but there have to be properties out there where that pass-through model still works, where borrowing long and lending short, or leasing long and leasing short. Well, borrowing the land, lease has that ambiguity where both the lessor and the lessee lease. History of English podcast, check it out. It's probably a good reason. So you're borrowing land and lending. So there must be places in America where that is still viable. And so as long as the business was before bankruptcy structured in a way so that landlords who are suffering losses on the rejected leases don't have claims that are going to interfere with the value of those continue to be viable leases. And I think WeWork sounds like they're pretty good at structuring that. Although there's a detail there, which I'll get back to in a moment. But as long as that happens, there will be some kind of nugget of a company that can still emerge in much stripped down form. What I was going to mention was it seems in some of the previous pre-bankruptcy restructurings, some of these landlords said, I will only accept concessions on the rent. In other words, I'll let you pay me less rent, WeWork, if I get guarantees from the parent company. So now, if there is a bankruptcy proceeding, I don't just have a claim against the particular LLC that holds my lease and actually doesn't have any assets in it, but now I'll have a claim against the parent as well. Now, I don't know how much value is there at the parent. Maybe some of those landlords will get shares in the reorganized company rather than getting nothing and liking it. But it does seem that with that aside, the company has been structured fairly much like kind of like a ship with watertight, I should say, compartments, so that if one floods, it doesn't bring down the others. And so the compartments that are still not underwater in the sense that they're still viable could survive.
I almost see, ironically, that the off-sharing model that WeWork, you know, uses might work out to be a benefit for all of these companies and people working in Midtown and on major cities that are scaling back their own leases, that are asking half of their workforce to work from home or come in sometimes. You know, they may actually on a smaller scale work ultimately, even though it was the pandemic and the pullback from going in and being social distancing and all that that caused WeWork to, you know, have all its problems.
Right. That's a good point. It may very well be that demand for shared workspace might not fall nearly as much as we anticipate, because it does suggest, well, maybe you're this way too. I like to do some of my work from home and some of my work from the office just because I like the change of scenery, right? Yeah. And so it may be that people who want to work from home sometimes also want to work somewhere else, and that will continue, especially if more people are not now associated with a permanent office that is available to them 24/7, like in the standard office model, like in a law firm or an accounting firm or something like that. And certainly the supply of new land available, supply of land available to support that type of shared space is increasing, precisely because demand for the old permanent long-term lease or single tenant office space is decreasing. So this may simply be a matter of adjusting prices, in the sense that the WeWork business model has a certain amount of viability, maybe in several cities, but when it was signing up those long-term leases originally, it was paying a lot more for the land than it could recoup, because the land value or the office building value has decreased since the pandemic and then the work from home kind of economy. But once those long-term leases are repriced to reflect the land's present market value, there may be something viable there again in many places.
Yeah, so there may be a path forward for
WeWork. That's right.
So is this also a cautionary tale for investors? Of like, when you see a wacky, eccentric startup founder who wants to run a business in an unconventional way. I mean, I know you compared him to SBF. We're not saying
more contrast than compared.
Contrast. But I feel like this has happened a couple of times in the last few years, where you see this young, you know, college dropout, apparently he never graduated before, and he's got all these wacky ideas and he's on top of the world.
He's a charismatic guy.
Yeah.
He had, maybe still has kind of a charismatic wife, right? I think his wife is Gwyneth Paltrow's cousin or something.
She is, yeah.
Right. So there's something glam about them. Yes.
Yeah. And it's just like, he's got all these big ideas and he's talking about solving world hunger and just saying a lot of unconventional things.
Right.
He runs the business in a wacky way.
Right.
And it's, for some reason, it excites investors. But then this is always, not always, but this is often what happens. It's like adults have to come in and clean up the mess. And is this not such a cautionary tale for easy money in these instances?
It's a really interesting question. What are the investors thinking? So there's two possibilities. One is that the investors themselves want to put their money in places that they feel like have social meaning or some broader meaning, save the world level meaning. I don't mean that as parody, but when you talk about raising global consciousness, I don't know what else you're doing but trying to save the world. So some of the investors themselves may say, I will accept more risk or a lower expected return because I'm not going to just do well in my investment, but I'm also going to do good in the world, right? It also may be some investors are thinking, well, actually, I just want to do well. I don't care about doing good. But a lot of other investors are thinking this. They want to do good. The employees want to do good, and the customers want to do good. So there's demand for this kind of socially responsible or socially interesting or socially at least marketed business, so that even if the individual investor doesn't care about it that much, others will, and that will keep the company afloat and support valuations that may be higher than a description of the business model, which I think just stripped down straightforward. Yeah, we lease land long-term or office space long-term and rent it out short-term.
Yeah, like how boring is that?
Right. It's like a bread and butter kind of business in many ways. Yeah. So that would have a certain normal valuation associated with that. It doesn't even seem particularly, it's not a high tech thing, unlike-
Not a tech thing at all.
Right. It's not particularly internet. So this comparison with the sharing economy, I think Uber is a brilliant product, but Uber is driven entirely by what made it possible was the internet, was smartphones, and then these amazing algorithms that Uber can come up with to figure out, okay, here's how we get to the cars to the right people at the right time. Here's how we price it and so on. There's a real new product there in a way, and it's based on new technology. Airbnb is obviously pretty heavily dependent on the online business as well. This isn't even particularly an online business, so it's not new tech. So what's new here? But yes, maybe what's new here is the and what's participating in the new economy is the social kind of socially responsible kind of investing emphasis. So I don't give investment advice. I'm very boring in my investments in the sense that I buy index funds. So when a company gets big enough, I own a very small slice of it. But I do think that there is, certainly if I were an investor who was picking individual stocks, I would say there's a trend. And Amy, you're identifying the trend, right? There are these companies started by young, very charismatic, but a little bit unconventional types that end up in bankruptcy. And maybe all of the excitement and hype around that does tend to lead to an overvaluation of the company. And I need to be a little bit more wary of that. Now, interesting, there was already wariness in 2019 with respect to this guy, which is why the first IPO was aborted. But that may have been not because of his kind of funkiness and this kind of, you know, his casualness is another way that I think that he can be compared to SBF, but because of specific concerns about the way he was extracting money from the company.
Yeah. And is it true? I read that despite its, you know, growth, it actually never turned a profit. And it was completely always kept afloat by Silicon Valley and VC money.
So that's a standard Silicon Valley kind of company, however. So the dot-com bubble, going back more than 20 years now, was fueled by companies that basically, many of them never became profitable in an accounting sense, but they had tremendous valuations because the hope was always some combination of growth and then a realization of the ability to, once they were big enough in a market, they could start harvesting their market share, they could price their products, and then huge amounts of revenues would come in. So eventually they would be profitable. But these companies were basically, what was relevant for them was not their profits per share, but their burn rate, which was how fast they were burning through their investment capital before they ran out. And yes, WeWork was always on the burn rate model. It never hit profitability. But there was the hope that it would turn the corner sometime and get there. And it certainly was growing very fast. And it is true that when a company is growing very fast, it's hard to be profitable at the same time.
Okay. Well, maybe one day. Thank you for coming. You always have such an interesting take and useful insights whenever a company goes bankrupt. So I was glad you joined us today.
It was my pleasure. I guess the bottom line here is it sounds like a new thing, but it's really as old as a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in certain ways.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks to everyone at Fordham Law School, especially the Dean's Office and our Corporate Law Center donors for supporting this podcast. Bite-Sized Business Law is produced by We Edit Podcasts. Listen and subscribe to Bite-Sized Business Law on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. The information in this podcast is for educational, informational, and entertainment purposes only and does not constitute legal advice, nor is it intended to promote the organizations with which our guests are affiliated. For more information, check out our show notes, and thanks for listening.